Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does energy have to do with art? Beyond providing creative people with light and power they need to do their work, new forms of energy have also transformed culture as they've come into common use, changing the ways we travel, congregate, and communicate, and in turn having a profound influence on the ideas we explore in art. Barry Lord is here to talk about this. He is co-president of the consulting firm Lord Cultural Resources and author of the new book Art and Energy, How Culture Changes. He's in town to speak tonight at 7 at the Nasher Sculpture Center. Barry, welcome to Think.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
You write that you first began to connect art and energy when you were in Saudi Arabia in the 1990s. What were you doing there and what made that experience so profound?
Well, we're museum planners. I say we because it's my wife and myself. Our company, Lord Cultural Resources, we do planning of museums. And I was there working on the planning of the new National Museum of Saudi Arabia, which actually opened in 99. We worked on it for about 4 years previously, right through to design and fabrication of the exhibits. And during the time there, it occurred to me that, of course, we were very much involved with the heritage of Saudi Arabia, but the actual everyday life in Saudi Arabia was very different. And, of course, the main reason was that there had been a tremendous change in the energy base of that society, with the discovery of oil in the 30s and then the development of them after the Second World War, particularly from about the 60s forward, really the whole society had been totally changed. And what I found was that really the center of the culture was not the mosque, but the mall. Hmm. It's easy to say, you know, to kind of sneer at that and say, you know, well, this is a sort of a totally commercial culture. But in fact, what I realized was that this was a very meaningful culture. Now, everybody's pretty familiar with the Industrial Revolution and coal and what a tremendous change that made to our cultural values, not just in general, but very specifically who we think we are. Prior to coal and the Industrial Revolution, particularly in Britain, you might be a serf, you might be a peasant, or you might be a landowner, or you might be somebody in the middle serving those people. All wealth was based on land. And of course, after coal and the Industrial Revolution, that was totally changed. Wealth was no longer based on land. It was based on the production process. And people were now defined in relation to the production process. You were either a worker or you were a capitalist or you were somewhere in the middle serving, you know, people like that. So a totally different culture had emerged with the Industrial Revolution and coal. That's pretty well known. It's been well discussed and so on. But what occurred to me was, being in Saudi Arabia, what do you know? We have another lab, if you like, a lab of what happens when you change the energy source, right? An energy transition had resulted in a complete change in the culture, but a very different change from the change that happened in Britain and then spread around the world with coal and the Industrial Revolution. So then it occurred to me that actually there's a general phenomenon happening here, which is that energy transition, the change from one energy source to another, results in a change in culture and a change in who we think we are at a very basic level. And having seen that, then I thought, well, let's look at other energy changes and other energy transitions, electrification, nuclear energy, and of course, renewable energy today. But I went all the way back, of course, to the mastery of fire and also to social sources of energy, because organizing ourselves, for example, cooperation was, of course, one of the earliest sources of energy, where we found that, of course, as individuals, individual men are hopeless as hunters, quite futile when we're not equipped with any other weapons. But as when we start to cooperate, we are, of course, the most feared hunters in the world. So cooperation was a way of making our energy much more effective. And, of course, it led to the culture of collective identity, which is to say those who cooperate had a collective identity together. Those others who aren't part of the cooperating group, I'm not at all sure about, right? And so that culture of collective identity, of course, led on into nationalisms and everything that came with it eventually. But the each of these energy sources, you see, generates a new culture, a new sense of who you are. And that then is added to what it is to be human. They're all still around because all those energy sources, as long as we use them, even occasionally, and unfortunately, even slavery, which was an enormously important social source of energy for the ancient world, the energy of slaves was extremely important. It was, in fact, the distinguishing characteristic of civilization at one time. That, unfortunately, is still with us in some places and in some ways. And so each of these energy sources is still with us. So the cultural values are still there. But there's a whole history of which ones are dominant, which ones are incoming, and so on. So at the present time, of course, renewable energy is a new incoming source of energy. And the values that come with it, well, you can start a fight at any cocktail party. You just have to say renewable energy, and people will line up on pro and con sides, and you'll have good conversation for the next hour and a half, or maybe not so good. But anyway, you'll certainly have controversy. So, and that's because those values are new. Those are incoming. They're not yet established. But what happens when we become dependent on an energy source, as we have been on oil and gas for the last 50 years, which, of course, completely replaced our previous dependence on coal, what happens when the energy source becomes dominant is that we take the cultural values that come with it, the idea of who we are, we take them simply for granted. We don't talk about them anymore. They simply are there. So the culture of consumption that came to us with oil and gas, that is simply the sea that we all swim in.
And we forget that by the nature of what we're talking about here, when we embrace one set of cultural values based on energy or any other outside influence, that means we have to set aside something else that has come before.
Yeah. You see, when you think of it, think of Homo sapiens. We are the only animal that reaches for other energy sources. All other animals have kinetic energy like us. They have sexual energy for reproduction like us. But we reach out for other energy sources, beginning with the mastery of fire, right? So we, of course, we in doing that, we actually created a culture, you know, and that is the uniquely human aspect. It is really what distinguishes us as human beings.
Well, let's talk about fire, because this is something that we recognize was important. But it, when you talk about cultural change, having a fire to gather around was absolutely something that fundamentally shifted the ways that human beings spent their time together.
Yeah, in the book I call it the culture of the hearth, but you could call it the culture of community. It is what made it possible for us to be a culture. Of course, another distinguishing feature of Homo sapiens is that we, in order to give birth to babies who have tremendous capability for learning, they are born well before they're anywhere near being even physically able to take care of themselves. And we have a very long period of care, of human care that has to be given to our young. And for years and years. And so in order to sustain that, we have to have some form of, if not a family, certainly of a kinship group that are going to be able to sustain, especially when you consider the high rate of maternal mortality at that time. And, of course, it still is unpardonably high. You know, 500,000 women each year still today die in childbirth, not because they're ill, but because they're giving birth in conditions that are culturally not supportive of them, that are actually preventing them from getting the kind of care they need. So when you consider the high rate of maternal mortality that there would have been then, of course, it's important that we have a whole kinship group to take care. So how does that kinship group define itself? Well, of course, the mastery of fire, which appears to come from our hominid ancestors, probably Homo ergaster or Homo erectus, appears to have had the initial hearths. It was around the fire that the group that was going to support these babies, that was going to make sure that they grew to adulthood, that's where the group gathered and identified itself.
And some of the earliest art objects that we've discovered go back to the energy and the resources that went into childbearing. And there are a lot of early fertility figures.
Yeah, primarily sculpture. These great works of sculpture which are usually you can hold them in your hand for the most part, and they mostly show women with very pronounced breasts and backsides and so on. They're usually very ample women,
healthy enough to have a baby.
Yes, they're showing that they really had the capacity to not just have a baby, but to actually survive having the baby and to carry on. So they're an ideal, as it were. They are an ideal of beauty in that sense. I mean, something like the Venus of Willendorf is really misnamed in the sense that it's not a pinup, but it is an ideal in terms of the capacity to keep us going. And you see that is enhanced by the mastery of fire, and then of course enhanced by cooperation. Now, as I said, we often talk about cooperation as an energy source because it allowed men to become better hunters, but cooperation was also critical among women. Cooperation among women to actually give birth and bring up children, and to some extent, of course, to control childbirth and so on. All of that depended on women working together. Obviously, mothers and grandmothers and siblings, sisters, and so on. But really within initially the kinship group and then within the larger group that developed once cooperation became a major energy source, then you had the potential for a larger group, which was not limited to kinship, but more broad.
The book raises the tantalizing question of whether cave art, which most certainly was drawn or painted by the light of some kind of fire, whether torches were invented so that cave art could be created, or cave art could be created once torches were invented?
Well, not only torches, but lamps, actually. Mm-hmm. Were the most exciting finds I find in the caves are we found two or three of these beautiful little lamps, which is the most important invention of that period. Here we are at 40,000 years ago with these simple little lamps that, of course, had oil put in them and a wick, and that, of course, was absolutely critical. Now, it is amazing, but you can read whole volumes about cave art and what it all means and so on without any reference to the fact that it all depended on light. These paintings were made in the pitch dark of caves. You can't do it without these lamps.
My guest is Barry Lord, co-president of the consulting firm Lord Cultural Resources and author of Art and Energy: How Culture Changes. He's in town for an address tonight at the Nasher Sculpture Center. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education with courses in art, culture, history, communication, photography, and film studies. Registration online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Barry Lord, co-president of the consulting firm Lord Cultural Resources and author of the new book Art and Energy, How Culture Changes. He'll be speaking tonight at the Nasher Sculpture Center and Thursday the 23rd at 7 at the Fort Worth Museum of Science and History. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or you can email think@kera.org. Another interesting energy source that I had never really thought much about was our ability to harness the power of the wind and to travel all over the world.
Yes, the wind in our sails, as I entitle that chapter, is certainly one of the most interesting subjects that we deal with in the book. And of course, the cover of the book is one of those great Dutch paintings of a ship in a storm about to be wrecked against the rocks. Now, that's a very peculiar subject. When you look at it, you think, why would that become a popular subject in that period? Well, of course, you can find the answer to that in Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice, or in his play The Tempest, where he deals with precisely that subject. What that picture is a picture of risk, because the development of the new rigging, which actually begins in the Mediterranean, in Venice particularly, the arsenale, which is where the Venice Biennale is held every 2 years. The Arsenale was, of course, built as a shipbuilding center. The capacity to build larger ships that could carry more cargo, greater distances, begins in the late Middle Ages in the Italian cities of Venice and Genoa and others. And, of course, what you find coming along with that is, first of all, the need to actually share the risk, because these voyages, beginning there and then, of course, becoming much longer voyages as the Portuguese, the Spanish, the English, and especially the Dutch develop these worldwide voyages with still larger vessels, which look small to us today, but, of course, were the largest vessels ever made at the time. And this was the first global transportation system. You could actually, go around the world, as Magellan proved first, and then, of course, as the Dutch became used to doing in the spice trade, which was a way to make an enormous amount of money, or to lose your fortune totally if the vessels were wrecked. And that's what happens in The Merchant of Venice. If you recall, Antonio, the hero, is of course ruined when it appears that all of his ships have gone down. At the end of the play, miraculously, it turns out this is not true, but in fact, it appears that all of his ships have been lost. That's why he can't pay Shylock, and so that is the whole plot of the play. Well, that kind of win-or-lose scenario with these vessels became more and more difficult as the ships got bigger and the voyages got longer and the potential for profit got bigger and bigger, but also the risk. So in order to share the risk, the British and then both the British and the Dutch invented the British East India Company, the Dutch East India Company, and these were conceived, especially by the Dutch, as mutual companies that you could buy a share in. The Italians had a somewhat similar system, but not really fully worked out. The British and the Dutch really worked this out, and of course it led to not only that company but other companies being formed like it, and that of course led to the stock exchange. That's where the stock exchange came from. So the whole culture of investment is born out of wind in our sails, and then coming with that, you see, culturally, it is the fact that investment is an individual decision. If I try to sell you right now on investing in my company, Lord Cultural Resources, and I say, it's a great company, you're going to make a lot of money, and I'm suggesting that you invest whatever amount in it, you're, of course, going to be asking yourself, is that really what I want to do with that amount of my money, as opposed to something else? Investment is an individual decision, so the culture of investment is also a culture of individualism. Mm-hmm. And so we find in the Italy of Florence and Venice and Genoa, in the Italy where these ships were first going and where this whole question of investment first became an important agenda item. Of course, then you have actually the development of the Renaissance portrait. Suddenly, it becomes very important to actually depict individuals, much, much more so than it ever was in the medieval world, in the feudal world.
Where we had archetypes and people who represented mythological figures more than actual individuals?
Well, in the medieval period, of course, it is all around faith, all around the religious values, and so individuals might be shown as the donors, the patrons, but the real interest was in the saints, mm-hmm. the saints and what had happened to them, and so on. These stories of the saints were what were being depicted. But in the Renaissance, we start seeing these individuals being represented simply as portraits in and for themselves, the value in and for themselves. And then, of course, in the 17th century, we see much more so the entire culture becomes focused on individuals and the narrative about them. So Cervantes, in the late 1590s, invents the novel. That's a whole new art form. And in 1600, just a few years later, the opera is invented. Again, a narrative about individuals, right? And then we get, of course, the tremendous focus on individuals, which is expressed not only in Shakespeare, but in Molière, in Vermeer and Rembrandt, who, of course, adds his magnificent self-portraits and Vermeer's great portraits of individual women in these Dutch interiors, which are furnished with the results of what the ships brought back with them,
including
the highest
pearl
level
earrings
of culture at the time. Mm-hmm. Sorry,
I was saying including things like pearl earrings and little
baubles
from
pearl
all over
earrings,
the world.
Of course, came from the pearling in what we sometimes call the Middle East. Really, it's West Asia. In the Persian Gulf, you had these pearls coming with on those vessels. They brought them back, along with the spices, and of course the slave trade was the other major source of wealth. Again, something that there was a lot of potential for investment in, and where again you could lose or win depending on how it went. Notice also in all of our schools, and this is true not only in English-speaking countries but in all of the European countries, when you're studying history, suddenly you come to the age of exploration, and suddenly all these individual ship captains are there. So you have Henry Hudson, and you have John Cabot, and you have Raleigh and Hawkins and so on. And they're marvelous, swashbuckling characters, or they're miserable characters, but they all have individual personality suddenly. And that, again, is that individualism, which was shared by both the investors who were making these individual decisions to invest in these trips and, of course, the ship captains on whom everything depended, whether your ship came home or not. So that it's all about the culture of investment, the beginning of the stock exchange, the world of business as we know it today, all originates from that, along with this great culture of individualism.
So, Barry, throughout much of human history, whatever fuel we could get was really dependent on what we could scrounge, right? We could kill a whale or a bear and render some oil and light a lamp with that. We could go out into a forest and chop down a tree and take that home, or we could make charcoal. What changed as we decided that property was something that could be owned by individuals?
Well, the culture of property, it does come very much with the dependence on firewood. 90% of the trees that were chopped down in the Middle Ages and the early modern period were cut for firewood. What you just said about you go out into the forest and chop down. Well, you better not do that if you're a peasant, because in fact that forest was owned by someone, and they're the most terrible penalties. If you just glance at medieval history, you're always running into these accounts of these terrible penalties. People were drawn and and quartered and horrible things were done to them if they were found to have chopped down a single tree on property that was not theirs. So there's a tremendous emphasis on the culture of property. And, of course, that was because of the impending world's first energy crisis. The first energy crisis in our history was not in recent times, but rather the energy crisis of deforestation in Europe. Now, this relates to the fact that the energy of slaves really characterized the whole of the ancient world in all those places where it was warm enough that you could keep slaves through the winter. Hmm. Now, in northern climates, it really is not energy efficient to keep slaves. And understanding slavery as a source of energy is really critically important. You could not keep slaves economically in the winter, not only because you had to feed them during a time when they were not very useful on the farm, because there was not that much to do in the north on the farms during the winter, but worse than that was to keep them warm. And to keep them warm meant cutting down more trees, and that would make deforestation even worse. What was happening on a local level, of course, there were lots of trees growing in Russia and in Scandinavia and so on, but that was a long way away. If you were a peasant in France or Germany, there's a great deal of this in Germany. Martin Luther, in fact, talks about, writes about the danger of deforestation in his own time, in the 16th century. And so if you were a peasant in those countries, or in England, of course, where it was really at its worst, it became harder and harder to find a place where you could chop down some trees for firewood. And so there became a need to really go underground, which the British, of course, were in the lead to do because they had the worst case of deforestation. They went underground. It was originally, coal was called Silva Subterranea, the underground forest is what coal was. And so that coal then replaced firewood as the primary source of energy.
So coal really fueled the Industrial Revolution. It was a much denser energy source than anything that you could find in the forest. The Industrial Revolution had such a profound impact on human history, but one of the things it did was create this sense that we were consumers of products that were made.
Well, yeah, not quite yet. Of course, what the real focus of coal was on production. It is a culture of production. It made possible mass production for a mass audience. That's mm-hmm. true. But to get coal on the large scale, to get pit coal, you had to be able to discipline large numbers of workers. Originally, women and children too, but eventually just men. But you had to be able to have large numbers of them able to work together in a very disciplined way. So the work ethic becomes extremely important, and the discipline of that workforce becomes extremely important. And of course, if they organize and they resist management for various reasons, they want better working conditions, then of course there's a struggle there that is inherent in the whole situation. So class consciousness and self-discipline, of course, was quickly seen as the best form of discipline, is always self-discipline. And so in the 19th century, coal and the Industrial Revolution brought us universal compulsory public education, a brand new idea. You know, a brand new idea that came out of the Enlightenment in the 18th century. It had been conceived then, but it became law in the 19th century because of coal and the Industrial Revolution and the need for a disciplined workforce, for a whole culture of self-discipline. And that is really what comes with coal. Now, with oil, to skip forward to that, there's a couple of other chapters in between, but just to skip forward to oil and gas, this is not at all true. And this is what I saw in Saudi Arabia that you were asking about earlier. It's not at all true. We've worked with Saudi Aramco. You don't hear discussions about the workforce in terms of the productive workforce to produce oil. If it's a knowledge industry in the sense that you have to know where to sink your pipe. Once you've got Once you've got the oil well, and you can connect the pipes to your market, then of course the value nexus shifts entirely from the production end to the consumption end. Mm-hmm. So oil and gas bring us the culture of consumption. So if you go to an OPEC meeting, you hear what's on the agenda is how many barrels, what's the price, and what is the demand. That's all about consumption. So the culture of consumption, which brings with it, of course, the whole focus on brands, the whole focus on credit. Coal, as I say, brought us universal education. Oil and gas brought us universal credit. And you have the proof in your purse or your pocket, which is a credit card, right? You have the credit card, which is made out of oil, actually originated as loyalty cards among gas stations so that you would stay with a particular brand of gas. You were given a card so that you could buy, that particular brand of gas. It was then taken over, of course, initially by department stores and then by the banks, and we all know that, you know, this is what made consumers of us all. As I say, these cultural values are about who you are. So under coal, you were defined in relation to the production process. You were either a worker, a capitalist, or you were serving one or the other. But with oil and gas, you are defined simply as a consumer.
And I suppose consumers at times have railed against this idea, but it's hard to get outside of it.
Yes. It doesn't much matter with these values. You see, the energy source is what makes the culture possible. We simply can't have it. We can't be here in this studio talking to each other without the energy base that supports it. So it doesn't honestly much matter whether we approve of the values that come with that energy source or not. We have to accept them. We may rail against them. We may organize against them. We may do everything we can to prevent them. But we have to accept them because there's no other way. I arrived here last night on a plane that was fueled by oil. You know, so the acceptance of the energy source, the culture that comes with it, is something that is universal. Even when what we're doing with the culture is to oppose the values that come.
My guest is Barry Lord, co-president of the consulting firm Lord Cultural Resources and author of the new book Art and Energy, How Culture Changes. He's in town for an address tonight at the Nasher Sculpture Center and Thursday at the Fort Worth Museum of Science and History. We'll resume the conversation in just a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education with courses in art, culture, history, communication, photography, and film studies. Registration online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with the co-president of the consulting firm Lord Cultural Resources, Barry Lord, who is author of a new book called Art and Energy, How Culture Changes. He's in town for an event tonight, sponsored by Business Council for the Arts at the Nasher Sculpture Center. He'll also be speaking at the Fort Worth Museum of Science and History on Thursday at 7. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5333. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. So there is coal, and then there is oil, and then there was nuclear power, and remains nuclear power in some parts of the country, some parts of the world. And with nuclear power as a major energy source comes a lot of anxiety.
Yes, the culture of anxiety has really been localized in nuclear energy. And it's most interesting because, for one thing, nuclear power is the one energy source that came to us first as a weapon, and a weapon of mass destruction at that, unless you want to count fire. I mean, to some extent, fire was, of course, also available as a weapon. But since then, this is the first energy source that has come to us first as a weapon. But also, what's most remarkable about it is that the culture preceded the advent of nuclear power by many years. It actually starts in the 1880s, and we see evidence of it very clearly in the paintings of Edvard Munch and Vincent van Gogh. It is coming out of the anxiety that is produced as soon as we define ourselves in relation to the culture of production. As soon as we say that who you are, really what matters about you is your relationship to the production process, well, that is an alienating factor for most people. You know, not everybody is totally happy with being defined in that way. And yet, economically, socially, and so on, that is really what coal and the Industrial Revolution did. It changed the who people were and where wealth came from and what life was all about. Well, that alienation, which is set about then, begins to be expressed in the 1880s and 90s, exactly at the same time as electrification, which is, of course, an application of energy, but also draws on hydroelectric power, a different source. Electrification is leading to a kind of much more intense culture, which I call the culture of transformation, because electrification has been inspiring us now for about 140 years with the possibility of completely changing the world. It begins, of course, with Edison, the electric light bulb, 1879, the possibility of changing night into day. Not just with an oil lamp, which is kind of a dull glow, but rather with intense light that literally makes night into day. If you can change night into day, what can't you change? And of course, what electricity has since done is to show us that with electrical appliances in the home and the factory and the office, we could change the role of women totally. We could change our ways of communicating with each other and our entertainment systems and so on, totally transformed. And then, of course, we could change the climate with air conditioning. If you can change the climate, what can't you change? And now finally, of course, with digitization and IT in our own time, of course, we've changed totally everything. We have changed the whole business of knowledge, how business is done and so on, and we can prove that to ourselves and notice how quickly we become dependent on these things by simply a little computer shutdown, and what do you know, everything
is falling apart.
Yeah, exactly. We all fall on the floor. So that, of course, was enormously inspiring and led to a whole century, the 20th century, in which for the first time in history, millions and millions of people believed it was possible to change the world. So what electrification says is you could be a change agent. You could be the instrument of change. And, of course, we had movements ranging from communism to fascism. We still have feminism. We have many other movements, all based on the fact that we can actually change the world. And it goes on today. It's still very much with us. But it did set up a lot of anxiety among people because it prods to change, while on the other hand, the whole culture of production coming from coal and the Industrial Revolution prods to duty and insists on duty. So we have this sort of tension, and out of it comes the culture of alienation and anxiety, culture of anxiety, which is expressed very strongly by Munch and Van Gogh. And then, of course, becomes realized in the two world wars, World War I and World War II, which are, of course, the product of the culture of production. It is the Industrial Revolution that made possible the incredible carnage that never before had we understood how terrible the carnage could be. And of course, you have artists responding to that and so on. So we have a great deal of work which produces this. It all culminates eventually, of course, in both the Holocaust and in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Both of these in 1945, bringing this whole alienation and culture of anxiety to a very real climax. And then, of course, out of it, You have in 11 years after 45, in 1956, you have the first nuclear power station. You have the first peaceful application of nuclear energy. And so, of course, the whole culture of anxiety, for very good reasons, because, of course, of the storage problems, of the control against accidents like Three Mile Island and the huge accident in Russia. We're well aware that there are great risks with nuclear energy, and so it does indeed gather around it this culture of anxiety, which, however, has been with us right from the beginning, with all of these new energy sources continually saying to you, you could be something else. You could be, you are defined in relation to the culture of production, but you know what? You could change the world. And then, of course, can you really? And if you do, what happens? And we all saw that. Now, in the arts, of course, this is international modernism. The idea that you could change the arts and you could use the arts and architecture to change the world was a fantastic idea of the beginning of the 20th century, and it's all around us now. This world in Dallas and Fort Worth and so on today, these buildings, everything that's in them, this all came out of that conviction, which really was rooted in electrification.
We've become accustomed to the idea in the wealthy West that with control over energy comes great power. And this is something that we've been comfortable with because we've been at the top. What are we to make, and what is the culture making of the fact that we have seen an exponential demand for energy coming from the developing world? And what will that mean for us, say, half a century out?
Well, the clearest indication of that is when you think back to Henry Ford, who in one of the early manifestations of the culture of consumption, Henry Ford invented the idea that you could buy cars on time. And, of course, his vision was that everybody could drive a car. And that became part virtually of the American way of life. Everybody should drive a car, right? Now, flash forward and apply that idea today to China, where it is, in fact, being worked out, and in India, where it is just about to start. If everybody in China and India buys cars and drives them, the planet simply cannot sustain it. And so we understand now that Henry Ford's idea looked very seductive at the time, but when you apply it to the whole world, it simply is not sustainable. So the whole values of sustainability, of course, lead to the what is today the new incoming energy source, and that is renewable energy. And I know you have a lot of Texas, of course, is famous for oil, but it's also now famous for the wind farms in West Texas. And so renewable energy is now coming in, and with it comes a culture of stewardship of the earth and stewardship of the body. And these are very different cultures that are totally opposed to the culture of consumption. You see how renewable energy holds forth the idea that you can, out of solar and out of wind especially, you can actually have energy without fuel, nothing to buy, totally against the culture of consumption. And the idea that a building, your own home, your office, your factory, your museum, these buildings can be producers as well as consumers of energy. And the two-way grid is a vast development against the old grid that in which you were only in a position of a consumer. So this is a very different culture, this culture of stewardship and the values that come with it.
Are the moments when one energy source gives way to another as the dominant force, are they particularly fruitful for the production of art?
Artists are, I would say creative artists are those who respond to the new ideas as they're coming in. So Andy Warhol, for example, was the genius of the culture of consumption. Now, you can think back to Scott Fitzgerald, the Great Gatsby, in the 20s, the roaring 20s, anticipated the culture of consumption. He saw it. It was already real then. Of course, oil was already, very much apparent. But oil becomes dominant. It replaces coal as the primary source of energy in the 1960s. And it's precisely at that time, in the early 60s, that Warhol sees the implications of the culture of consumption. So he paints Mao Zedong, he paints Jackie and Liz and Marilyn and Elvis. And he knows in each case that the brand of those people, they will be perceived through their brand. And so he produces like 14 Marilyns, all in different colors, all with different light effects, sometimes glowing, sometimes very dark. Sometimes she looks very, very morose and very sad, very suicidal. At other times she looks magnificent, and glowing. He doesn't care because he knows that her brand will always come through. And because she is perceived as a brand, because we now see our leading people as brands. And in fact, of course, today with the social networks, everybody is trying to develop their own brand. They are a brand on the web. So universal credit and brands are what come to us with the culture of consumption. So somebody like Warhol really anticipates that. Now, today, of course, we have artists like Jeff Koons. Just did the retrospective in New York. What you have there is, for example, a brand new, at the time, brand new, get the word, a brand new vacuum cleaner Koons puts into a glass box, and he exhibits that in his new series as a work of art, because he understands that it is precisely that respond to the brand that constitutes what the art is about. That's a very, very intelligent understanding of the culture of consumption. But the big difference is that for Warhol, it was a discovery, whereas for Koons, a generation later, it's simply a received idea. We're all living inside the culture of consumption.
So the idea essentially is to figure out where we are now for artists and continue to describe it. Are artists trying to predict what's coming next?
Well, they're very much involved with the advance of the culture of stewardship. Earth art, for example, is, of course, all kinds of art that are involved with, the values of Earth, of the Earth, of the planet, in many ways. So that is a whole stream in itself. And remember that it's stewardship of the body as well as of the Earth. And so performance art, of course, the artist takes their body, their own body, as their art form, as their medium. So you think of something, the biggest news of the last 10 years or so was Marina Abramovich's piece just a few years ago at the Museum of Modern Art, where she simply sat in the gallery. There was nothing else in the gallery but herself sitting at a small table. And if you were visiting, you could go and sit opposite her for 10 minutes and look into her eyes. She would look into yours. You couldn't speak. She wouldn't speak to you, but that was the exchange. Now, it was extremely powerful. People left weeping, the actual experience. It was called The Artist is Present. Hmm. Now, how did it come about that an artist would think that that is a work and that the Museum of Modern Art would recognize it? You see, that is precisely the culture of stewardship of the body that is coming through very strongly.
Barry Lord is co-president of Lord Cultural Resources and author of Art and Energy, How Culture Changes. He's in town for an event tonight at the National Sculpture Center, sponsored by the Business Council for the Arts. He'll also speak at the Fort Worth Museum of Science and History on Thursday. Barry, thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a delight. Thanks very much. You asked a lot of good questions.
Thank you. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.